Hello and welcome to Warpod, the official podcast of the Remote Warfare Programme.
In our monthly Westminster Roundup podcast, we give you a quick roundup analysis of the two top stories from Westminster, chosen by Liam, that's him.
And Megan, that's her.
So Liam, what's your top story?
So Megan, my top story for April, which other than being a rather interesting month with regards to the B word, we had a really interesting development from no other than the Secretary of State for Defence, Gavin Williamson.
How exciting.
Absolutely. And very exciting because, as you all know, because you've been working closely with me on an area of work that we have been running at the Royal Warfare Programme, about the protection of civilians, which is part of broader work around safeguards when the UK is partnering with local forces on the ground, mm-hmm. building part capacity or countering terrorist groups, whether that's across parts of Africa or in the Middle East, in Iraq and Syria. And one of the big things that's come out is how is the UK ensuring that civilians are a key priority when we are engaging in this way. So, Gavin Williamson announced that the MOD would establish a Centre of Excellence for Human Security. And before all those cynics out there think, oh my God, not another Centre of Excellence for Human Security, another person in the MOD on sort of a desk somewhere that will be the Centre of Excellence for Human Security. We don't know. It's going to have a budget of around 2 million per year. Mm-hmm. But I think it's quite interesting because, you know, if you look at some of the media coverage around this, it's sort of setting the UK as the first country to sort of put human security at the core of its defence policy. And of course, we have a lot of work, we've done a lot of work around this and we have our own views on it. But I think this is really positive in the sense that there's a lot of momentum around the protection of civilians at the moment.
Yeah,
we know that, for example, the Foreign Office has agreed to review its current joint strategy on the protection of civilians in armed conflict. So we know that review's ongoing, which, as I say, is a joint strategy which will involve the MOD. So there seems to be some sort of shift here. Something's going on.
Absolutely.
There's some interest in this subject. And I think it's safe to say that, obviously, the human security covers a lot of things. I think you had a good
So it's quite a wide concept, and there's quite a lot of debate about what it actually means. I had a teacher who once said that it was security plus and survival plus, so just the external aspects to war, protecting civilians, and including gender aspects and different other social aspects mm-hmm. to protecting civilians in conflict.
Well, I mean, that was a good teacher, because
that was a very good teacher. He was,
that's a good summary of it. And, you know, these concepts can sometimes be quite complex in terms of who agrees
on
like, different definitions. Even protection of civilians as a concept is, you know, it's only been around probably since the late 90s when the UN sort of came up with this resolution on
absolutely.
Making sure that, you know, UN operations, peacekeeping operations would include a protection of civilians mandate. It is a developing and a concept. I think it's really interesting that we have got to this point where not only is the FCO looking to improve and review its approach to protection of civilians, given all the different mm-hmm. things that are going on, the MOD is also doing it. But from our perspective, what we want to make sure happens is that you know, we've got some concerns about, and we've discussed this, about the 2010 protection of civilians strategy,
absolutely.
Which is, it seems, quite focused on sort of peacekeeping operations, where the UK is contributing to peacekeeping operations, that there is sort of priorities around protection of civilians and that mandate is implemented through UK support. But I think from our perspective, it's also about where the UK is engaged in operations overseas like Iraq and Syria, etc., and how now that we are more often than not partnering with other local forces that don't have the same attitudes or share the same values, etc., about human rights or even understand the concept of IHL and protection
absolutely.
Of civilians, that how are we going to train those partner forces in ensuring that the UK commitment to defence, human security and its defence policy is then implemented on the ground and sort of comes to fruition when we're partnering other forces. So that is my big story of April. I think that's a really positive one. What's yours?
It is very positive. Well, just to add to yours, actually. So I think it's important to note as well that both the policy from 2010 and this current announcement of the new Centre of Excellence,
mm-hmm.
they both present the UK as this, like, the saviour that comes in to kind of show the good values, such as protection of civilians and gender awareness. And like you say, I think it's really important that both the centre and the new strategy kind of show how the UK can also protect civilians and do better than that when they are themselves involved in those operations, when they are conducting airstrikes.
It's not just something that the UK is doing to help others, but it's actually the UK reflecting on its own way of training its personnel.
Exactly.
And there's an interesting point where it says about that selected service personnel will attend a Centre of Excellence for Human Security. Is that like a training program or a conference or something? I don't know. But to cover these broad issues around countering sexual abuse, child soldiers, all the things that you talked about. So it'd be interesting to see how that works in terms of that training. But it is a positive thing and something that
definitely
we should follow with interest.
Absolutely. Great. Okay, so my story is actually cheating a little bit because my story is not from April, it's from March.
Oh, no.
I know. So in late March.
Get it right. We're cheating, remember.
5 UK Special Forces were injured in a gun battle in Yemen. This is quite troublesome in several ways. First of all, there were claims that the Special Forces had been working alongside child soldiers as young as 13 years old. That, of course, contradicts the UK's legal obligation and places the UK's moral credibility in the spotlight. But secondly, and more importantly to our work, it goes against repeated statements from the government that the UK is not at war in Yemen.
Exactly.
And that raises really important questions for us about the government's transparency about when the UK is at war.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something we've been looking into for a long time, and we have a hard time understanding the difference between combat and non-combat operations in the government's eyes. It's also important to note that when the story broke, there were allegations that Brexit was the reason that it wasn't given as much attention as it could possibly have been given.
Yeah, I mean, it was a big story, wasn't it?
It should have been
a big story, at least.
And it maybe wasn't as big as it could have been.
Yeah.
And maybe that is because of Brexit. So Andrew Mitchell, an MP, said that were it not for the all-consuming nature of Brexit, I suspect that the House would have wanted to explore this as a matter of urgency. And we do kind of think that that's true, that they would have been more focused if it hadn't been for the beat where it took everything else over.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there was a lot of anger going to the point that you make about, ministers have come to the dispatch box in the House of Commons on numerous occasions to say that we are not a party to this conflict. Well, it looks like we are. So, either the government doesn't know what special forces are doing, which raises concerns about where they're operating, what their strategy is, what their purpose is being deployed in this way, or the government is, just attempting to mislead the House of Commons and parliamentarians, which I think is really damaging, really, for that relationship between Parliament and the government.
And especially as special forces become more and more used, in warfare. It becomes more and more the way we engage in conflicts abroad. So it seems like it's something we should have better oversight over.
Yeah.
And it is worrying that the government appears to have gotten away with it as well because we don't have better oversight mechanisms as a whole for special forces.
Yeah.
It seems a shame, as we've argued many times before, that the government only engages in this when something goes wrong, that they never have that approach of talking about why they're engaging in different places, especially when the enemy is a very clear, bad guy, so it seems strange that they're not engaging beyond when things go wrong and they're called up by the media.
Yeah, and I mean, Andrew Mitchell mentioned, I think, in the House on the day that announcement came out, I think it was the 25th of March or something like that, that he wanted answers about where British Armed Forces were deployed, where were they actually injured, as one newspaper was reporting.
Yeah.
And the minister came back and said, no, we're not going to talk about this. So I think that's slightly concerning when you've got absolutely, as you say, no means to even debate the issue.
Absolutely.
How do you get around that? This is a major issue that the government needs to respond to, surely. And there is absolutely no mechanism for doing so. I mean, one of the things that we were sort of advocating for was that you would let the ISC have access to this in some form, some way, to be able to report to Parliament about what actually happened and what went wrong. I think that would have increased the trust between the government and Parliament and addressed this ridiculous scrutiny gap that appears to exist, where, on the one hand, you've got the government saying we're not a party to the conflict, and then this coming out, these allegations coming out. Now, of course, you could argue these are speculation, they're reports, but I think there was a general consensus across the political spectrum that these were pretty robust reports from the Sunday media back in March. So I think, absolutely.
And it wouldn't be unusual if the UK government was to introduce some kind of oversight. So most of their allies actually have that already. So in the report that we did last year, we looked quite a lot at the UK's allies trying to figure out if there were any systems that we could copy.
Yeah.
And we found that every single ally we looked at, every single Western ally we looked at, all has some kind of oversight mechanism.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make sense for us not to have the same thing here.
And it's just good to say that there are those that we did a deep dive of in terms of their parliamentary systems, weren't there? And then those that we looked at that might comment at least on special forces,
exactly,
like Canada or Australia,
yeah,
New Zealand. So yeah, I think it just seems peculiar that the UK has this policy where it just does not, even when there's something like this crisis,
exactly,
this scandal appears to happen, then there's no alternative.
Definitely. All right, well, thank you very much for your story.